Accession number 26934, Reel 2.
Are we okay? Arriving at I took the train down to HQ BOR at that time, and we're talking about 1951, I think it was at Bad Oeynhausen, which was a spa town in sort of central Germany, lovely place. And I went down there and stayed in the officer's mess for a couple of days while they sorted out a posting for me. And I was posted then to 7th Armoured Workshops, which was with 7th Armoured Division, the old Desert Rats. And they were at Halle, just north of Bielefeld in the sort of middle of Germany. So I was sent off to Halle by train, and I was picked up at the station by a driver in a truck. And he threw my luggage in the back and drove up to the workshops, which was in an old industrial building in Halle. Well, on arrival there, he took me straight to the adjutant's office, which was sort of around the back of the, in the offices at the back of the industrial building, and told me to go in through a door there, and he would take my kit to the mess for me to sort out later. So I went in there, and there was what I took to be a quite elderly captain. I expect he was about 30 or something like that, who standing outside the office was an ambulance. So I went in, and the captain said to me, "I've got pneumonia. Here are the keys. Goodbye." And he got in the ambulance and went away. So I found myself appointed adjutant of 7th Armoured Workshops, which is a pretty good post to be at when you're a brand new second lieutenant. So there was a nice desk, and in a tray and an out tray, telephones, safe to fit the keys. So I settled myself in at the desk and adjusted the pens and pencils around to my satisfaction, and the phone rang. And the voice said, I said, "Hello," which was wrong, of course. I should have said, "7th Armoured Workshops" or something like that. I said, "Hello." And the voice said, "Is that 7th Armoured Workshops?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Rhine Army here, charioteer." I said, "Pardon?" And he said, "Charioteer," and rang off. See, I thought, well, God knows what all that was about. Anyway, so the morning passed. The chief clerk came in. I signed a few papers and things like that. At lunchtime, I met the CO, who was called... I better not give his name, but he was a Scottish gentleman who looked something like the picture on the front of a bottle of Dewar's whiskey. A very hale and hearty chap. And afternoon came, and suddenly the CO burst into my office and said, "Did you receive a code word this morning?" I said, "Well, I'm not sure." He said, "Do you realise that the whole of Rhine Army is out on emergency manoeuvres except 7th Armoured Workshops?" So I really didn't have a very good introduction to 7th Armoured Workshops. Well, what you might call a rather shaky start there, I think so. I hope the code word's not still charioteer, and that I've given something away. I found out later by opening the safe with the keys provided that there were various code words. Charioteer meant, "This is manoeuvres, get out on the road, quick, this afternoon." There was another code word, I can't remember what they were, which meant, "We think the Russians might actually be coming, get the families back behind the Rhine and get out on the road quickly." And I think there was a top rate code words which meant, "The Russians are coming, get the families and yourselves behind the Rhine as quickly as you possibly can," you see. Anyway, unfortunately we never received the other code words, and at Bielefeld the Russians were quite a long way away.
So what was your current unit? It was 7th Armoured Division.
7th Armoured Division, yes. I think at that time there were two divisions in the British sector of Germany. There was 7th Armoured and 2 Infantry Division. I think later on, while I was in Germany, 6th Armoured joined. But really, we didn't have all that many troops there. In 7th Armoured, I think at that time, there was the armoured regiments were... I think there were two brigades, I'm not sure. 7th Brigade and 31 Brigade, but I'm not sure on this. And we had the Scots Greys, the 8th Hussars, and the Queen's Bays, and later on the 11th Hussars, 4th RHA, 8th RHA. Now I only know all this because I'll tell you about it later. But We didn't spend very long at Halle, Divisional HQ. We all moved up onto the Lüneburger Heath. The whole division moved slightly forward, I suppose. And 7th Armoured Workshops moved to Fallingbostel, which is the most awful posting in the British Army. I'm sure it still is. It was then, because Fallingbostel is a vast military complex built by the Germans, of course, who built splendidly for their troops. They had lovely buildings. No wooden huts there. No, beautiful buildings, beautiful, double-glazed, lovely sanitary ware. In fact, I went in one officer's mess, which had been a Luftwaffe mess in his time. Beautiful place, carved wooden doors, and lovely. And down in the cellar, there were the toilets, and there was a special set of basins with special hand grips and headrests to allow you to be ill into the basin, presumably as a result of drinking too much schnapps or something like that. And the Luftwaffe did things properly, you see. Anyway, we moved up to Fallingbostel, which was this huge complex of buildings and barbed wire set in a pine forest which stretched forever. In fact, it was a most dismal and desolate country. There was a little hamlet of Fallingbostel nearby, one hotel, the Beaumetal, where we congregated, but it was really not a very good place.
What were relations like with the local communities generally?
Well, generally speaking, we were not allowed to wear civilian clothes at that time. We had to wear a uniform. And generally speaking, we were well received. And we used to go out and drink in the local Gasthofs down in Halle and also up in Fallingbostel when we could find one. And the Germans, we had a champion, one of our second lieutenant. He could drink ale faster than anybody else. He could down a pint, I think it was 9 seconds or something like that. So we used to race the Germans in the bars, you see, and of course we had a champion. We beat them every time. They respected that. But they were generally friendly. I remember one German said, the conversation turned to London, he said, "Oh, I know the old Kent Road." I said, "Oh, how do you happen to know the old Kent Road?" "I bombed it," he said. they were quite good. The thing about the Germans was, they were so glad the Russians weren't there. And they were delighted that we got there first, you see. And so we were welcome. I remember one German saying to me once, I met him on a train, and he said, "When the war broke out, I lost 50 Reichsmark because I bet my friend 50 Reichsmark that the British would never fight the Germans." They liked us. And I never found any animosity at all. And in fact, we had German girls working as secretaries in the offices, and quite a few married British soldiers. It was not uncommon. Later on, you know, we were not allowed to fraternize at first. Earlier on, my first year or so, but afterwards the rules were relaxed, and after a couple of years, I think we were allowed to wear civilian uniform, civilian clothes, and you were still different though, because at that time, nowadays you can't tell whether anybody's a Swede or a German or English or whatnot, but in that time you could tell because the clothes were different. The British wore sports jackets and flannels and things like that, and the Germans wore sort of things that looked like their Black Forest hunting outfits, you know, so you could tell how different they were. The workshops were servicing mostly Centurion tanks, which was the standard equipment in the division at the time. I think most of the regiments, like the Scots Greys, had 52 Centurion tanks. And, of course, a great many soft-skin vehicles, B vehicles, which were all ex the war. And in fact, if you scraped the camouflage paint off, you'd find desert paint underneath some of them, and invasion stars and things like that were there. They were all old Bedfords, I think, Bedfords, mostly Bedfords, and Fords. And they were all right-hand drive. And of course, we were driving on the right-hand side of the road in accordance with the Germans. And the dimming arrangements were awful. The sort of left-hand light went off and the right-hand light skewered across the road into the eye of the oncoming driver. It was really very poor. When I arrived in Germany, it was really quite... I mean, I'd seen London after the war, which was fairly badly damaged. But nothing... that Germany was much, much worse. The houses were all very badly knocked about in town centres. Railway stations, I think railway stations, you'd see not the platform and the track, which had been sort of reconstituted, but just outside there, you'd see railway lines sticking out into the air and bomb craters and mess. There were every street sign was peppered with bullet holes. Every intersection of a major road was peppered with bomb craters, and many of the bridges had gone and were replaced with a Bailey Bridge by the government, by the army. And you could tell even where a bomb had fallen some time ago, because the trees around it would be skewered outwards from the blast, you know, permanently skewered, changed outwards. We used to have Germans working in the workshops, German fitters worked in the workshops. And of course, by then, we were on national service more than the old regulars were being demobilized from the war. And we were getting more and more national service. And these chaps of 18, 19, really, they weren't very skilled in maintaining equipment. They were not bad, but we employed quite a lot of German older men who were really skilled fitters, and they did a great deal of the work, if the truth were known. And the army employed German GSO units. These were sort of regiments in an anonymous green uniform, didn't seem to wear any flashes or tabs. And they provided transport using 3-ton electrically driven vehicles, all battery operated vehicles, which you never see anymore. I don't know why. I don't know why they were there at that time, but they were battery vehicles.
So what did you think of the national servicemen working for you?
Well, I thought the national servicemen were not really very military. They tended to be disappointing from a military point of view, slightly sloppy, badly dressed. And I think the national service was... I think it was good for the people who went through it. I don't know whether it was good for the army, really, national service. I sometimes used to think, you know, the Germans are very military-minded and very splendid militarists. They've always been militarists. And I sometimes used to think, I bet these fellows wonder how we managed to win the war with sloppy-looking troops like these, you see, because the Germans were always terribly smart. And, but anyway, I'm probably being overcritical there. But most national servicemen really only did about 18 months by the time they'd been through basic training and whatnot. And you can't really make a qualified fitter and use him skillfully in that time. I mean, I was basically very untrained for the work required to be done. You sort of had to learn on the job as you went along. I was adjutant at 7th Armoured Division, which means I was gathering the pay packets and doing things like that, administration, posting people in and out, which was really not what I'd been trained for. I had to go down to Celle, about 40 miles away, to collect the unit pay, which the paymaster would make up. He carried it all out in British Armed Forces vouchers. We used to have vouchers which you could only spend in the NAFI and in the officers' clubs. And we also, you could transfer them into Deutschmarks. So most people got part of their pay in Deutschmarks and part of it in BAFs. And they'd make all the unit pay up, which I don't know how many thousand pounds it was worth, in a cardboard envelope. So, and once a week I would have to go to Celle. I'd take one of the Volkswagens from the company. And, you know, unit transport was Volkswagens and a driver. Go down to Celle, go in, sign for the money, and come back. One day, coming back with the driver, I used to smoke at the time, and I realized I'd run out of cigarettes, you see. So there was a little village we passed through, so I asked the driver to stop, and rather than leave all this money in the Volkswagen with the driver, I took it into the shop with me, put it on the counter, asked for my cigarettes, bought my cigarettes, went out, got in the Volkswagen, drove away. And I'd gone about 10 miles before I realised I didn't have the money with me. So it's with heart pounding, turned round and rushed back, and there was the brown parcel standing on the counter where I'd left it. So I said, well, Vince, surely you can see bitter, and picked it up and got in the truck, got in the Volkswagen, drove away. Now, that, I think, would have been a cashier job if I'd lost that money. So while I was there, I was promoted to full lieutenant, sort of on a, just on a time basis thing. I grumbled about just doing administrative work, so they gave me the recovery section. I took over the recovery section of the workshops. Now, that was really good fun, especially during manoeuvres, because you were detached from the main workshops, and you went around on your own, and pretty much your own master. When a tank had fallen off the road, you stopped and dealt with it, and then followed up the division and found yourself a location large enough for the night, usually a farmyard or somewhere like that. The Germans didn't seem to mind the German farmers. I think they always deferred to the military anyway. They were used to deferring to the military, and it was just normal to them. So, and of course, the Lüneburger Heide, the Lüneburger Heath, has always been a military area, so they were very used to it. But we did do manoeuvres in other parts. We went down to Minden and right down into the Ruhr on one occasion, Aachen, down that way. But generally speaking, the manoeuvres as a recovery section were good fun. We had force camels, like the one you have there. Two scammels and four Diamond T tractors. I don't know if you know, the Diamond T was a large lorry with a sort of Nissen hut on the back, which was really for towing. And it towed tanks. It towed a 48-wheel tank trailer, which would take a Centurion tank. I think the Centurion tank overhang the trailer by about 6 inches of track either side. It only just fitted, because the trailer was made during the war for smaller tanks. So we had four of them and two of the trailers. One carried a D8 tractor, a Caterpillar tractor, and the other carried a Churchill tank, which was a much lighter weight tank, where the turret had been removed and it had a winch installed as a tank recovery vehicle. So that was our equipment, and I had a Jeep. So I forget how many men there were in this, about 30, I suppose, on the recovery unit. And our job was to just go around behind the divisional manoeuvres and clear up the casualties as they sort of appeared. A lot of the German roads were on embankments, and the tanks, if they got near the edge, had a tendency to crush the edge of the road and slip off. The roads, in any case, were all very badly rutted when I got there by tank tracks. Of course, a lot of the roads were cobbled, and the cobbles were pushed down by the tank tracks all over the place, and it was difficult driving in most places, because it was like driving in tram lines, you know.
You mentioned the Ruhr earlier. What was that like after
the Ruhr?
The Ruhr.
Well, I didn't really see much of it, because on manoeuvres we didn't go into the towns. I didn't see much of the Ruhr. No, I was further up in the Lüneburger Heath. But while we were there, I went to Hamburg. Hamburg was our recreation spot, really. And it was a long way away. And in fact, I went there more often later on when I was posted up to Lüneburg. And Hamburg was very, very badly damaged. Of course, it had 1,000 bomber raids and this sort of thing. It was really down to first floor level only, ground floor. People were living in the ground floors and the cellars. The other buildings had gone. Some were still standing. The famous Four Seasons Hotel on the Alster Sea was an officers' club, and a very good one too. You could get an excellent spaghetti in there for 2 and 6 pence, and you could drink yourself stupid for 5 shillings. Not that we did too often. And we used to all pile into there. There was an old Austin pickup truck, and we'd pile into that. Most of the young officers who weren't married and living out would pile into that on a Sunday evening and drive up to Hamburg and go to the nightclubs along the Reeperbahn. But there was another street called the Winkelstrasse, which is a very street of ill repute, which was boarded off and patrolled by military police, and that was out of bounds. We were not allowed in there. And of course, in the early days of going up there, we had to go in uniform, so we were in these nightclubs in uniform. And I went once with my captain, who was in charge of me. And I won't give his actual name, but it was a county name. Let's call him Captain Surrey. Anyway, Captain Surrey and I went up to Hamburg, and we went into a nightclub called the Silver Keller. And we sat down at a table and ordered the statutory beer, which cost 1 Deutschmark each. And I was sitting there opposite him at the table. he said, there were some hostesses at the bar, you see. He said, I'm going to go and dance with one of those ladies there. He said, take this. And he put his hand under the table. So I put my hand under the table, and he placed in it a 38 revolver. And he said, if they start anything, shoot at their feet. So, I mean, very difficult to conceal a 38 revolver when your service dress is a bit tight anyway. You get funny bulges in funny places. But it was what else could you do? That was what we did. I went once to the Planten and Blumen display in Hamburg, where this was later on when Joni had sort of recovered itself a bit, and they had a most splendid water fountain gardens with a musical water fountains. They played organ music and played lights and fountains with it. Very, very beautiful. Never seen anything like that in England at that time, anyway. Of course, for all the state Germany was in, they worked hard. They were pulling it together again. They were building hard. They were working hard. The German fitters we had working with us worked very hard. And you could buy anything you wanted in the shops. It was expensive for them, but for us it was reasonable. And the one thing you could buy there was nylons, which were unobtainable in England. And when we took on leave, we always took back nylons, which were in great demand in England. But an item of currency used on the black market was Nescafe. Nescafe was like gold. The Germans would do anything for a tin of Nescafe. And we had a cheap ration from the NAFE. And some of the people used to sell their ration to the Germans. I never indulged in the trade myself. Couldn't be bothered, really. But we had cheap cigarettes and cheap Nescafe. That was available for us. And both good currency in Germany. Now, I'm losing my track here. Now, while I was with the recovery section, we went out manoeuvres, and one evening, late in the evening, the Royal Engineers had to throw a pontoon bridge over the River Weser near Nienburg. And the River Weser is quite a fast-flowing, wide river. There was an ordinary road bridge. The Nienburg Bridge was still there, but they didn't use that. They had to throw a pontoon bridge over, so they threw it over nearby, and they put pontoons across the river and laid the decking down. But there were sort of flat fields either side of the river, and they were a bit boggy. But anyway, when a bridge over like that is thrown over a river, the first vehicle across is the Remy Scammel, because it goes to the other side, and lays out its winch cable across the bridge, so that if anything sticks on the bridge, it can be winched off quickly, you see, and kept clear. So I really should have put chains on the Scammel wheels, but I didn't, because it's an awful job putting them on. I didn't think it was necessary. But anyway, I sent the Scammel across, and when it got off the duck boarding the other side of the bridge, it sank down in the mud. And we tried to pull it out by laying the winch back across the bridge and ground anchoring it to this side of the bridge, and then winding it in and driving the Scammel backwards. But all it did was churn up the mud, and eventually when it got the duckboard boarding, it pushed the bridge, and the bridge concertinaed like a pack of cards, sort of in a zigzag shape, which totally wrecked it. So the whole advance of the division was blocked, and there was a general storming and raving around, taking discretion as the better part of valour. We were in shirt sleeve order, so I concealed myself in the Scammel and removed my pips from my shoulders and passed myself off as one of the Scammel crew while the general ranted and raved. Anyway, he had to take the division over the civilian bridge up the river and pretend that that was the pontoon bridge. I don't think I was really all that successful as a recovery officer, but there you are. From Fallingbostel, to my great relief, I was sent off to the Scots Greys at Lüneburg. I was promoted to temporary captain and took over the Scots Greys at Lüneburg, Light Aid Detachment, which had a staff, I think, of about 100. and we had 52 Centurion tanks to look after, and I don't know, quite a lot of soft B vehicles, soft skin vehicles. And we had all various trades there, and while I was there, we didn't start with 100 men, we started with a lower complement of men, and there were unit fitters. They belonged to the Scots Greys, because at that time every regiment had its own fitters as well. And Phase 2 REME was introduced, I think it would be 1952. And Phase 2 meant all the unit fitters were brought into the REME fold and changed their cap badges and shoulder flashes from Scots Greys to REME. And the Scots Greys did not like that at all. But there was nothing they could do about it. And they, for a time anyway, they wore REME and Scots Greys insignia. But just to show that they were something different. But they had to come in, and that's when the unit grew to about 100 men. And I had to do a certain amount of posting and reposting of people, because the trades laid down for the regimental fitters were not the same as the establishment for the REME LAD. And one particular chap was a welder, and I didn't have... I think I already had a welder. I didn't need a second welder, so I posted him out to some other REME place. He was happy to go, actually, because at least in REME you get around and you move and you see other regiments and things. If you're in one regiment, you're with the same group of people all the time. He's quite happy to go. But shortly afterwards, the colonel came to me and said, "What did you do with trooper so-and-so?" And I said, "Well, I didn't have an establishment for him. I've posted him. He's gone." "What?" he said. "This chap... He's got a special uniform made for him for the presentation of Hewitt's Eagle at Edinburgh in commemoration of the Battle of Waterloo in the summer, and you've sent him away." I had to get him back. I had to get this chap back. So we had 52 tanks. We did just component exchange, really, on these tanks. If something went wrong, the tank was backloaded to workshops for repair. And if the workshops couldn't deal it, it went back to base workshops, of course. We had the Centurion tanks had Merlin engines, same as the old Spitfire, and a huge epicyclic gearbox, which was bigger than the engine. The tanks, the engine plates at the back, there was quite a big deck of an engine plates at the back, which used to get lovely and hot. So on manoeuvres, it was a good place to sleep, on the back of the tank, because you had a nice warm bed for the night. I never forget the smell of the wet mud on the exhaust pipes of those tanks. It's something that sticks with you, because the tanks tore terrible holes in the countryside, you know, or especially through the woods, huge. And the only thing really that would follow them would be a Jeep. And Jeeps were very good. They'd go anywhere. I had a personal Jeep when I was... at one stage I had a personal Jeep, and I loved it. Although the first one I had a hand-operated windscreen wiper, which was a bit of a nuisance, changing gear with one hand and working the windscreen wiper with the other, and trying to joggle the steering wheel with your knee. But they were wonderful vehicles. There was the Willys Jeep and the Ford Jeep. I think the Ford Jeep had a round bumper and the Willys Jeep had a square bumper.
Which was the one that you had?
I had a Willys Jeep. I think mostly the ones we had were Willys Jeeps. The local workshops had knocked up some box bodies to go on them with windows and things, sort of weatherproof, and turned them into like saloon cars. But the general didn't like that, and he had them taken off, and we went back to the canvas hoods and the open-sided Jeep, which could be a bit damp in wet weather. Now, while I was up at... the Scots Greys, which were absolutely fine regiment, wonderful officers mess to live in, and very, very, very enjoyed my time there very much. We used to go skating in the evenings on the ponds. They lent me a pair of skates, they had skates, and we used to skate around. I found the living expensive there. In fact, the colonel said to me, "If you get into money troubles here, you must come and see me," because, of course, some of them had plenty of money and lived quite lavishly. But anyway, it was all right. They looked after me. And adjacent to the barracks at Lüneburg, where we were, there was an airfield with the RAF on it. And they had taken over the old gliders operated by the Luftwaffe. You know, the Luftwaffe learned to fly in gliders before they were allowed airplanes before the war. So they had a very big gliding establishment. And the RAF took them over, and the winches and associated equipment, and they ran gliding school, weekends and evenings. So I went along there, and I started to learn to glide using a thing called an SG-38 primary trainer, which was a glider with no fuselage. It just had a sort of stick fuselage and a wing and a tail plane, and you sat on a seat on the skid in front with a joystick and rudder bars and no instruments at all. And you had to judge your speed by the whistle of the wind in the wires and things like that. And you learned solo because there were no dual machines. They only had solo machines. So you started off by being slid along the ground. They call those ground slides. And then they winched you a bit faster and pulled you in the air and let you down again. And then they pulled you up and let you cast off and land. And then they pulled you up and let you cast off and do a turn and land, and this S-turn. And when you were confident, and of course, the thing about a glider is that the instructor could stand by the airfield and shout instructions to you because there was no real noise, apart from the wind whistle in the wires. And then they took you on a circuit, and you did a full circuit, and they controlled you with bats. I found...